Chapter 6. The Crew of the Pequod. Now that our whaling voyage has begun, let me tell you something about the crew of the Pequod. There were three mates, Starbuck, Stubb, and Flask, who made sure that the crew followed the captain's orders. When we were hunting whales, each of these three men was responsible for one of the three whaleboats. Starbuck, a Nantucketer with a wife and child at home, was a tall, thin, handsome man. He was a good man. He was brave when he hunted whales, and was wise and intelligent, so he did not take unnecessary chances in the dangerous work he did. Starbuck's job was to kill whales, and no one knew better than him how many hundreds of whalers had been killed, his father and brother among them.
"I will have no man in my whaleboat," said Starbuck, "who is not afraid of a whale."
Stubb, the second mate, was a friendly man who did his job without fear. He did not seem to care about its dangers. Even as he was in his whaleboat, fighting with a whale, he would be whistling a tune. Whatever he was doing, we never saw him without a pipe in his mouth. Men said that when Stubb got up in the morning, he lit his pipe before he put his trousers on. The third mate was Flask, a short, strong, red-faced young man with white blonde hair. He was a very ordinary man who did not think deeply about anything, so he did not admire or care about the wonderful whales he hunted. All he wanted to do was destroy them. But he did his job well, and the crew trusted him. Each of the mates had a harpooner in his boat. Starbuck's harpooner was Queequeg, who you have already met. Next was Tashtego, an American Indian who worked in Stubb's boat. He was a tall, strong hunter with long, straight black hair and deep brown skin. He used a harpoon as well as his relations used arrows on land. The third harpooner was Dagoo, who worked with Flask. Dagoo was a black African who had left his own country as a young man. He was a huge man, and little Flask looked like a toy beside him. So, now you have heard about the mates and their harpooners. The captain and the mates lived at the back of the ship. So did the harpooners, but in a different place. The rest of the crew lived at the front. Every man of the 30 on the Pequod knew where he belonged on the ship. Most American whaling ships were organized in this way. For several days after leaving Nantucket, we saw nothing of Captain Ahab, and the mates were responsible for the ship. Each time I went on deck, I looked toward the stern to see if there was a new face on the quarterdeck, but Captain Ahab was never there. I still felt worried, remembering the strange words of Elijah. Then, finally, the captain was there, and what an amazing man he was. He was a tall, strong, elderly man who was as brown as the wood of an old sea chest. He had a short beard, and a long, thin, white mark came out of his gray hair and all the way down the right side of his face and neck till it disappeared into his clothing. No one knew if he had been born with the mark or if it was from a terrible injury. I saw how grim his face was, as if he was remembering some terrible sadness. And then I saw that his missing leg had been replaced by one made from whalebone. There were two shallow holes in the quarterdeck on either side of the mast, and Ahab always put his bone leg into one of them and held on to the rigging to help himself stand. After that first morning, as we sailed south, Captain Ahab was often to be seen standing like this or walking the deck. Gradually, as the air became warmer and the sky became less gray, his mood improved. Soon, he spent more time on deck than in his cabin. Often, he tried not to walk around very much, so that the noise made by his bone leg did not disturb the men who were sleeping beneath the deck. However, when his mood was grim, he forgot the noise his leg made and walked continually up and down the deck. Late one evening, I saw Stubb running up onto the deck and heard him speak to the captain. He would not have spoken in a joking way if he had known the captain as well as we later did.
"Captain Ahab," he said, "could we get a piece of cloth to tie round the end of your leg so that we may sleep peacefully?" "Do not speak this way to me," shouted the captain. "Go below, you dog."
Stubb looked so surprised that he couldn't speak for a moment. Then he said,
"I'm not used to being spoken to in this way, and I don't like it." "Avast!" cried the captain violently, as if he wanted to hit Stubb. "No, sir, I won't accept being called a dog," replied Stubb. "Go, or I will kill you," cried the captain in a terrible voice, moving towards Stubb so violently that the mate turned and ran. Neither of them saw me, and I was glad of that.
It was during better weather that I took my first turn as a lookout at a masthead. It was usual on American whaling ships for there to be a lookout as soon as a ship left its harbor, even if it was 15,000 miles to the hunting grounds. And a lookout would be on the masthead all the way back home in the hope of one more whale to kill. All the sailors took their turn to stand 100 feet above the deck on one of the three masts. We stood on 2 thin pieces of wood fixed to the mast, and we held on to the rigging. For a beginner, it was as comfortable as it would be to stand on the horns of a huge deer. The lookout's job was to shout if he saw a whale. I have to say that I wasn't a very good lookout. Far away from everyone, looking out over the huge, empty sea and feeling the ship gently rolling beneath me, I used to get lost in my thoughts. During the whole voyage, I regularly forgot the instruction given to all whaling men: keep your eyes open and sing out when you see a whale.